Welcome to the December 10th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week, let's see, I did upgrade a few more videos as Ham Radio Now 2.0 gets them done. So two got added since the last time I told you about it. So they slowly come trickling out, and I've been doing some programming, working on some web pages, and some JavaScript programming this week. So that's it for that part of my activity. Also, Scotty, I took on one of those jobs. I'm sorting pictures for a tapper, so I'm thinking about that as well. So that's it for me. Next on the list is Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I've been working on various things. Worked up a version of the magnetometer board with one of those sensors, the MCP9808 or whatever it is.
User joined your
channel. On it, ordered a minimal number of samples of those. They'll be a while. Got a few chips, so. I'm finding that both the I squared C, well, so far I've only worked with the I squared C extender chip, but I think the temperature sensor chips are just as bad. These are very, very small chips to work with, and I don't know, maybe the clouds will part, but I'm not sure how well I can actually solder these 3x3 packages onto the boards. I think they really have to be oven soldered, and I don't know whether I can come up with a kludge to do that personally. But otherwise, I've been working on all that, and haven't done as much with code, I don't think. As I probably need to. I need to get back to programming, but doing the board layouts. And I'm wanting to test even some of the early boards that are not so good to make sure they at least, the more obvious things work. So anyway, that's my week. Over.
One quick question, Dave. Did any of the second or third run boards show up in your mailbox?
The second run ones showed up today, late. Seems the postal service is delivering twice a day now to my house, and they are in the second delivery. Boy, they haven't done that since the 30s, I don't think. But in the afternoon delivery, they some of the second batch showed up. I hope to get most everything I have worked on by late next week, but this time of year things are kind of weird with all the shipping services are just maxed, I think.
Well, thank you. Next on the list is we have David in 1HAC, and he's shown his mic muted. Oh, David, you want to speak?
I'll just say hello. I'm able to connect in and see how things are going with the project.
Well, very good. Welcome. And next on the list is Mike, AAK, shown as recording and mic muted. And we thank Mike for posting the Tangerine SDR TeamSpeak archives to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Then we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody in the group. Been a pretty busy week. I've done a cleanup pass on the receiver to incorporate all the discussion we had either last Monday or the Monday before, I don't remember which, and got that shipped off to Scotty for review. It hopefully is getting pretty close to final now. And analyzed the group delay of the AM broadcast band filters and the low pass filters on the receiver, and sent out an email to the list with some graphs. Phil had a couple of questions, and I think we got those addressed. So that's about it for the week.
Well, fine business. Next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, Dave, thanks. And thanks again for running the show here. We really appreciate it. And good luck with that picture sorting. Sounds like you had some fun with that. Be somewhat relaxing if you don't take it too seriously. Sounds like there's a lot of it. So it could be fun, though. Anyway, this week, did spend a little time looking at Tom's RF-Port schematic. Looks pretty good, Tom. I did find a couple things that I think we want to address. But one of the things was concerning naming of jumpers. I think jumper should be named JP and connector should be named J, so maybe we can fix that. That's easy enough to do. The other thing is, what do you think about whether we should use 2-millimeter jumpers to save a little space, or should we stick with everything 10th inch? I think your connectors are all 10th inch. And so anyway, down to the nitty-gritty of like tweaking some part numbers maybe, and that's about it. But otherwise, looks very good. And looking for your opinions to see whether we're going to be able to fit it on the board in the space that we have. And didn't get much of a chance to work on the DE schematic this week. I'm hoping to get back to it this week because trying to get things going so we can have a reasonable chance of getting this done soon. So probably about halfway through it. So, but the spec is all completed, so just a matter of grinding through it. Anyway, I think that's it for this week. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion. Short group, since most of the scientists are in San Francisco.
Yeah, so what do you think about 30,000 scientists all getting together? That's even more scary than 30,000 engineers.
Well, there's a couple of big science meetings that are ESA is usually big, and the Geophysical Union is always big. But I tend to like the meetings that are more less than 300. They're usually more productive, and I get to talk to people I really want to talk to.
Yeah, otherwise it just becomes overwhelming, like Comdex used to be. We used to go there in probably the 1990s, and it was huge, bigger than the geophysical one. And there's really, toward the end, it started being just a show to try to sell you stuff. So it wasn't nearly as interesting as seeing the new stuff.
Yep. Yeah, I understand. Hey, I was a little nervous when I volunteered for that picture thing, and then I realized the oldest pictures in there are, at least that I've found so far, are 99. And really start about 06. And then I realized I've been around that long. So I know most of the people in the pictures.
Yeah, so a lot of it was HPSDR or later, right?
Yes, there's a little bit before HPSDR, but not much. And I've got two people that should remember those days pretty well right here, so I can ask questions when I get stumped.
Yeah, yeah, and you can also put them on the list, and there's lots of old-timers on there that'll know about the older people, older photos, I should say, that people that we don't know.
I noticed there's a few of Tom and Scotty that look pretty young.
Oh, we haven't aged that badly, have we?
Well, you never know.
Yeah, well, it's okay. I'm proud of the way I look. I earned every bit of it.
Yeah, just a few more gray hairs, per square millimeter.
Yeah, and more acreage.
Scotty, I have a question for you. I wanted to attribute them so that, you know, at least there's some names of who the people are in the picture, and they do have the dates and all that in the EXIF, so that's not a problem. But so am I being too advanced by stuffing those comments into the metadata, or should we just make a separate table that has picture number, date, and who's in the picture?
Yeah, it depends on whether they can read the metadata in the web software or not, because that's one of my big complaints about just slapping up thousands of pictures with no annotations. It's like, I want to go back and look, and you know, I may recognize me and Steve Bible and Tom Holmes, and then, oh wait, who's that other guy? I forget who he is, and they never say.
That's right, and so that's one thing that, you know, the academic in me wants to document who's in what image, or how do they get there, and what are they doing, and that kind of stuff.
But the good news is, if you put it in the metadata, it'll always be with the photo. So even if it gets separated from the table, you'll be able to do it. So, I mean, I guess if it's not too much work, I would do both of them, and or find maybe a program to extract the metadata and print it as a title or something, a header.
Oh, I could just write that. That's very easy.
Yeah, because if you put it in the metadata, it can never get lost, right?
So then all I need to do is write a little bit of code that you take a picture and then have a little JavaScript file that sucks out the metadata for the caption.
Yeah.
I have a JavaScript library for that somewhere if you want that. So there's millions of them in C and stuff, but there's one pretty good one for JavaScript.
Well, I knew I could depend on Dave. He's the one who taught me JavaScript. I kept getting frustrated and said, oh, you ought to learn JavaScript.
Yeah, hey, Dave, Dave Witten, that chip that you got, is it a chip with a pad on the bottom? Because I suspect you can get a different package that you could solder down more easily. That's a little bit bigger, like an SOIC. And then once you get all the functionality tested, you could build a board with the other one. Although maybe the purpose of this is to get the board with the real chip that we want to use on it.
Well, I definitely thought about that, but at least for the, let's see, the 9808, the PC, the MCP 9808, I think this is the biggest chip there is, and it's still only 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters. One of these two chips, no, I don't think this package of either one of them has a pad on the bottom. The leadless version of the thermometer, you know, the temperature sensor does have a bottom ground, and I started to worry about putting that into my footprint, but it turned out that it's not on these chips I have, and thankfully, because it would be tiny.
Okay, well, just a thought is that if you're just trying to get the sensor to work, maybe pick a larger package.
Yeah, I'll look further. User was moved to your channel. But, you know, we're getting to the stage of things where they've shrunk everything so much, it's, you know, you need to keep them in a salt shaker and just shake them out. Once I get the board's design stable, I was going to get a solder mask for it. I mean, a stencil. But I haven't done that yet because I'm not satisfied probably for a while yet.
I'd like to mention two other people that have shown up. We have Dan, N4XWE, and Rob Robinette was here for a minute, and then he has left. So just for the record, the audio record, they have attended for part of the time.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and speak, Dan?
No, thanks. I actually don't have much to say. I haven't done very much. I've not gotten my Vim 3 board up and running yet, although I plan to do that this week. And I'm sorry I'm a little bit late.
Oh, no problem. Speaking of Vim 3s, at the Mesa Hamfest this past weekend, I set up my battery-powered Vim 3 with an IQ2 and my portable HD screen, and I set it up at the Hamfest as a demo.
Great. How did it work?
It worked pretty good. The screen is not quite bright enough for outdoor use, but it worked okay.
You have that desert sun down there, I suppose.
Yeah, and the thing is, it was pretty cloudy and not really very bright, and it still washed out the display. So I need something with like 700 or 800 nits so you can see it from across the parking lot.
Yeah, here in Oregon, we'd call that a dazzlingly bright display.
What, 700 nits?
Just about anything's dazzlingly bright.
Oh, you mean when it's raining all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
At this time of year in Oregon.
Well, Tom's getting ready for the inversions coming here in a month or so.
Yeah, we've already had a couple. The airport got closed down due to fog.
So, Scotty, the whole valley fills up with fog, but if you go out in the mountains, it's clear and sunny. It's just atmospheric layer inversion.
Yeah, we actually had fog here this morning in Arizona, but it wasn't like your fog because it was just like a little mist that you could barely see.
Yeah, the inversion's interesting. As you gain altitude, the temperature gets warmer as you bust through the fog and into the sunshine, and so you go up to get warmer.
Is that what causes the fog to sit down low?
Yeah, it's cold down in the bottom of the valleys, and so the fog settles down. And then once it stays foggy, no sunlight gets in, so it doesn't warm up.
Okay, so I'm looking at the data sheet here, Dave W., for the temperature sensor. It looks like the DFN package is 2x3 millimeters, and it has a pad on the bottom. So you must have gotten the SOP package.
Yeah, what they call the MSOP.
Right, right. So it's a little bit bigger. It's like 3x4 millimeters instead of 2x3 millimeters. So I guess that makes it twice as big.
I'm still pretty sure I could keep them in a salt shaker and shake them out as I needed them.
I've got an entire, 0.65 millimeter lead center to center spacing.
Let's see, I'm looking.
It's 0.5 pitch. I had to reduce the size of the contact pad on the default size on my board design, but down to 1.45. I had it at 1.5, and I was getting errors because the pads were too small.
It looks like it says 0.65 millimeters, Dave.
Yeah, and it's, which isn't the smallest thing I've ever dealt with, but it sure is little.
Well, the good news is there's only four pins on each side.
Yeah. I'm gonna experiment with it. I put one on, but I really think there's only about a 1 in 4 chance that I got it on functionally.
A little solder wick could probably clean that right up, won't it?
It's hard to say. I may have to try some different soldering equipment than I've used in the past.
It's really bad when the solder tip's wider than the pins, than 2 pins.
Oh, definitely. But I've actually done a lot of, I've done FPGAs, I've done a lot of real fine pitch stuff. But when they get into these little packages, for some reason, I find it difficult, but I had some boards made a little differently that they kind of look like I might be able to see better what I'm doing.
Yeah, okay, well, good luck. It's definitely going to be fun. Like I said, my scouts are at your disposal. I want them to help build boards, but probably building one board is not so much worth it. But when you get to ready to build, 10 or 20, they can definitely help, and they love doing that little teeny stuff. They got good eyes. They can still see.
Well, mine are probably a lot worse even than I know, and I will definitely be happy to leave any production assembly to others. But yeah, it's not worth it. I've got to be able to build at least the first one here somehow. I'll get there.
Yeah, and Dave, KV0S, I see Rob Robinette came in. Rob, do you want to say something?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello, can you hear me? Okay, I'm actually talking to you from my car this time. sorry, I'm late. I'm not sure. I don't know how relevant what I've been working on is directly relevant to you, but perhaps you'll find it interesting. One area is that Gwen Griffiths, my associate and colleague and friend, has prepared an article for QEX magazine. I think we were asked to do this about the noise measurements, whisper derived noise, ionospheric noise measurements that I discussed at the DC conference a little bit. And this article, I think we've shown we're seeing some interesting results from the measurements and some insights into what one might hope to learn. And I was thinking perhaps, Nathaniel, you would be, might find a few minutes to review that. And we will mention, the group. And I think certainly mention HAMSCI as well as, the Tangerine SDR. I'm not sure we mentioned Tangerine actually in this, because it's not relevant, but I'm hoping that that we're encountering various limitations in the Kiwi, which we can work around, but I hope that they will be addressed in Tangerine. But in any case, there's a 6,500 word article with a bunch of diagrams and charts, and that I'd hope at least you, Nathaniel, might find a few minutes to review before we forward it on to QEX. So that's one activity that's actually mostly Gwen's. The second area that, to the extent that any of you are involved in whisper use, I've been we've been experiencing serious problems with database logging across the internet to the whisper net database. And as a result, I've come into direct contact with at least one of the maintainers of that database. And it appears, they're under stress In part, I think, because of my Whisper Daemon program pumping so much data into the WhisperNet that their server is becoming overwhelmed. So I've been doing work to debug my uploads to them. And this information and experience, I think, might be relevant to, experience that you guys may, hope to have, I think, when once tangerines and the personal weather stations are being deployed. So that's kind of my area of activity. It's the debugging has really been consuming me because dealing with internet transactions and errors associated with interacting with the database across the fragile internet has been an area that I'd hope not that I wouldn't have to become experienced in, but I am now. So that's my report.
Okay, very good. Well, Nathaniel's not here. This is Scotty, so I'm not sure whether you're asking Nathaniel or Sasha.
Oh, okay.
I'd be happy to review the article for you.
Okay. Well, who's this? Oh, okay. Oh, Ned. Yeah, that'd be great. This is. Okay. Well, it's all. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It wasn't Ned. Who is interested in it?
This is Scotty. WH2DFI. I'm. I'd certainly like to help review your article if that's what you'd like.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Well, I was going to send it off. I guess Nathaniel's out here at the H2 conference, and maybe that's why we're not, or he's in transit, perhaps. I don't know why he isn't here. So.
Yeah, Nathaniel, I know, is off at the geophysical conferences with Phil and Christina and Hayoman. And and David from Case Western. So they're all off. I'm sure Nathaniel, when he gets back, would be more than willing to help you read it and make suggestions if that's what you're looking for. I can help more from a QEX format point of view, since I've done a few articles. And I'm just curious, have you sent it in? Has Kai accepted it, or are you still getting ready to send it?
No, we're getting ready to send it. Kai, I think we sent him the presentation PowerPoint, and he kind of encouraged us to prepare it as an article. And so we're responding to his, to his quest for an article. Hopefully, we're not really out there to promote. Our work, but we do share it with people, and if it's a venue, the event where people are interested, I'd be happy to do it. And if not, we'll put if Kai isn't interested, we'll I'm sure find some other way to share this. But we are we are learning a lot about the noise measurements in receiving. We now have a group of sites. Moment we have four sites that helped at KH and in California, KA70EI and in Utah, and then a guy down by Las Vegas and a guy in northern Utah. So we have a kind of a square of receive sites, and we hope to be able to derive further insights into the what we can learn from ionospheric noise measurements from data gathered from those four sites, because we'll have a kind of geographic triangulation of measurements. There's some really intriguing things we're already seeing just from the two sites, APH and KA7. So anyway, I hope that this stuff would be informative to whatever the personal weather station data gathering sites deployment stuff. I think we're kind of doing this on a prototype basis, and the infrastructure issues and what you could extract from this is hopefully would be relevant to what goes on with the.
Well, any free plugs for Tambourine you can give us, we'll accept. And if not, you know, that's fine. But if you want to email me a copy, I'll be happy to read it.
You know, I guess I. Great. You know, the. You know, I wasn't clear. Maybe I'm, you know, I'm not close enough to the project, so I'm kind of a lurker here. But, you know, one of the, you know, we are using the Kiwis and receiving, you know, in basically as our source. And in fact, some Kiwis are now running in a 14 channel mode. So one Kiwi can listen to all 14 of the low frequency through 10 meter whisper bands at the same time. So with the Tangerine project, are we going to be able to extract you know, multiple demodulations sessions off of one Tangerine? Is that a goal of the project, or is this going to be channel kind of stuff?
Nope, that's definitely one of the goals. And one of the other goals is to make sure that any shortcomings you find in other SDRs that you're using, that we address those and solve those. So, you know, anything that you want to see, now's a good time to talk to us, because we want to make sure that it's going to be all things to all people, as I say.
well, you know, the biggest limitation we encounter with the Kiwi is its poor noise figure. That John, you know, saved money appropriately by not doing a sophisticated you know, front end RF amplifier. He has a 20 dB gain, you know, a Linear Tech 20 dB gain device, which is potentially low noise, but to get it to exploit it as a low noise device would have required balanced transformers and so on the input, which would have significantly raised the cost of the Kiwi. So John chose not to do that, and I think appropriately. But as a result, the noise figure of the Kiwi is on the order of 17 or 18 dB. And
so Tom, can you
for quiet receive sites.
I just wanted to ask Tom to jump in and comment on that noise figure.
Yeah, I'm surprised at that noise figure. The on the current Tangerine receiver, we don't have an RF amp. We just have that same single-ended to differential transformer and the 20 dB gain A to D converter. And when I look at the ADC driver, has got a 6 dB noise figure. And when I look at all the other losses, I come up with something on the order of 7 or maybe a little bit more dB noise figure for the receiver. And so I'm interested in why maybe it's so high as 17.
Well, you would be much better able to judge this. The design of the Kiwi has a I don't know the exact Linear Tech parts, but there's a Linear Tech A to D, 66 megahertz A to D, 14-bit A to D, preceded by a Linear Tech 20 dB gain amplifier that does the it ends up being a single-ended to differential amplifier, and as I understand it, optimal implementation of that is to have transformer couple on the input and so on. And I don't know whether Glenn Elmore, N6GN, or other, maybe I misinterpreted it, but I think that the Glenn said that the implementation doesn't follow Linear Tech recommendation. And Glenn said that he thought that John did that in order to save money on the on it, and probably for most of the target audience of the Kiwi is not researchers and not people with inherently low noise receive environments. So I think that, you know, the Glenn, as I understand Glenn's discussion, that the Kiwi optimization is to is for cost, not for low noise figure. But I would the Kiwi schematic is open source. You can get it off of his GitHub page, and or I can send it to you if you get it. It would be
I posted the link down there, it would be very interesting. I posted the link to the schematic down on the bottom of the page.
Okay, very good.
Okay, we already okay. Well, that's, no, I don't.
Yeah, one of the things that we did, we use a differential transformer and use the driver in a differential in, differential out mode. But the second thing is that there's a lot of different A to D converters, and the noise figure of them varies dramatically. So we chose one that had the best one that we could fit into the $51 for two channels kind of range. There are it's one of the better ones in terms of a dynamic range and receiver. So it may be a combination of the way the driver is used and the particular converter chosen for low cost. It's hard to say. I got the schematic up. I'll take a look here.
Okay. Well, I would welcome your comments because you know, in so many ways the Kiwi, in terms of its user interface, the wonderful support I get from John, the architecture of it and the interface is just perfect for me as a, you know, as a software developer. I don't try to run my software on the Kiwi itself. He provides a Python library, an API that I can I run remotely that allows me to tune, you know, attach to a Kiwi and tune to it and get streams that way, and that works extremely well for my application. It allows me to completely disconnect the analysis, decoding and analysis of the data from the receiver itself. So I can run, if I needed to, as I do, I need to run on a fairly powerful CPU. So I've been running, well, now I'm running on a 4, seems to be the right target for my analysis. And so I don't have to worry about impacting the performance of the Kiwi's post-processor. I'm just completely disconnected from it. And I really like that architecture. It really cleanly separates the receiver functionality from any of the data and signal processing of the demodulated signals. So that architecture I like, and I'd hope that hopefully the Tangerine would provide a similar kind of utility for remote tuning and listening. In which case, of course, as soon as something's available, I would love to take one and put one out at a KPH, which is apparently, from everything we can see, one of the quietest receive sites around, certainly on the West Coast. And it would be great to be able to pair that against it. What we're doing with the Kiwi is we're putting a DX Engineer Clifton preamp ahead of it. And in almost any deployment, I think you should provide for that. I don't know if you're provided for bias T a power as in the design, but I've found that that's pretty much necessary in order to minimize the effects of locally induced RFI from cabling and other things. I'm almost in any site that I'm all the sites I'm working with now, we put preamps out as close to the antenna feed point as possible, which means you got to have a bias T. You need to have a preamp that can take the bias T, that doesn't pick up and amplify common mode from the from the bias T power and lines into it. So there's a whole bunch of systems issues that to some extent need to be considered, I think, in the RF stage input RF stage design, especially the bias T thing, because I've been struggling with noise introduced by the the feeding power to the remote preamp. I mean, it's you're down at the quiet levels we are at KPH. You know, we're talking about, you know, signals that, you know, we're measuring down at, you know, 10 dB above of KTB off the antenna. So the smallest, you know, common mode introduced into the receive, line transmission system will show up in our out spectrums. And I haven't yet suppressed all of them. They're an area that I'm not an expert at, so I'm having to learn at, and I still haven't succeeded completely at KPH.
Yeah, the design right now is set up so that ground is completely isolated, and so it's the front end has got, it depends on how many picofarads of capacitance there are, but it's going to be 5K or 10K ohms of common mode isolation built into the front. So if you want to provide a bias T, you're going to need to do that external. And it's got to be a special bias T. It's got to not only decouple the signal, it's also got to decouple the ground, because if the bias T just brings ground in, you'll automatically short out all the common mode rejection by the bias T. So I took a lot of pain to try to provide extremely high common mode isolation.
Yeah, I at KPH, achieved some improvements by introducing, you know, isolation transformers. I've been using the mini circuits T1-1s as an isolation device, which provides, you know, at 50 ohms at least, provides about 30 dB of common mode rejection up at 30 megahertz. So it's pretty good. It only goes down to the transformer itself only carries, you know, differential signals down to about 100 kilohertz, but that covers our range. And so that's been the solution I've had in front of the, so at KPH, you know, the patch in front of the Kiwi is to put a Clifton 23 dB Clifton out at the antenna, you know, feed point, and then put in one of those T11s, get rid of any as much common mode as we can right in front of the RF input of the key. And that does a pretty good job. It's you know, but I think in the real world, this issue of how do you get rid, you know, how do you minimize the introduction of you know, of RFI from common mode on the incoming feed line is a bigger issue than the A to D, you know, noise figure. Really, it's you know, the benefit is not so at KPH is not so much from the you know, of the Clifton isn't so much the you know, better noise figure as it is that it basically, by putting 23 dB gain out at that feed point, in effect reduces the RFI ratio of signal to RFI by 20 more, and that was a big deal. A big improvement, and one that I think that most real world deployments will encounter. I mean, most home users suffer. John Ackerman is an example of this. I mean, he's got terrible RFI at his house, and we're pretty, you know, I don't know, we haven't heard from him for a while, but Glenn and I were working with him, and it appeared to us that you know, he was, his common mode noise was coming from the Wellbrook or whatever bias T injector and system that he had going to his loop antenna. It wasn't so much the actual noise in his neighborhood that was the source of his problems.
Yeah. So Tom.
So I would expect that a pretty common problem.
Hold on a second,
if
Rob.
It's not directly part.
Yeah, I just wanted to get interaction here rather than a monologue. Because you asked a lot of questions and made some comments, and I want to make sure that we address your problem of being able to put a Clifton amplifier out at the antenna and a special isolated bias T. We could put that on the front end of your RF board, Tom, and it would be doable, and it would solve the problems that Rob's having. Am I reading that right?
I think it would be a very difficult challenge to put it on the front end of the board. The reason is that it has to carry power and ground from the system through to the antenna connector.
Tom?
Yes.
Maybe I misstated that. I'm talking about putting the Clifton amp out at the antenna and using it, putting the special bias T in line, not on our board, but external to us, but with the isolated ground that you had mentioned.
Yes, that's what I'm recommending. I thought you were asking if we could put the special bias T on the receiver board, and I think there are some issues there.
Yeah, and I think we don't want to do that, but we want to not preclude Rob from doing it and making it work.
I'm all for that.
Yeah, that's not an issue. In fact, the architecture that we have, I think, helps, if anything.
Go ahead, Rob.
That would be great. Now, but I would, you know, if I've missed the fact that there's a commercial product that would do all this, that's fine. But and I would welcome that. It'd be helpful to me right now. But so it sounds like it's being addressed it sounds like you're very much aware of this issue and have addressed it as much as appropriate in the receiver.
Well, yeah, because we're using a transformer that you specified, right, Tom? That we're transformer coupling, so that won't be an issue. Just making sure the bias T has an isolated ground, that'll be the main issue.
Yeah, the receiver front end takes all the signals differentially and brings them up to the 1-4 transformer, which converts it from single-ended to balanced. It does that without any connection to ground anywhere. And so by doing that, there's no common mode that will come through the front end of the receiver. The difficulty is if you use just a standard bias T outside of the receiver in the connector, the first thing it will do is short the ground lead of the antenna to some power supply ground doing bias injection, which defeats the common mode isolation.
So it sounds like...
are there products or designs that do that properly, the bias T?
Yeah. You could do that by splitting up the bias T inductance and putting it both in the power and the ground leads, and then you would achieve common mode rejection in the bias T. Basically, you put the inductor in both legs instead of just one leg.
But then the bias T is going to determine your common mode properties, right?
Yeah, the leakage of the bias T. The receiver won't degrade it anymore, but it'll be the design of the bias T. But then you have that bias T design under your control.
So we could build one of those just for Rob.
Yeah, and then in the case where folks don't need that, then they don't have to install that in the antenna lead. So it kind of works in both cases.
Okay, Rob, well, hopefully you solved your problem.
That, Tom, instruction and directions?
I'm sorry.
I'm looking for the design, but yes, the architecture's right. And
Yeah, I was, it's a little unique. I haven't seen a receiver do it this way before. We also have a jumper on the board, so you can short the ground of the antenna to the system ground if you want. And there's people who like to use, like a 10-foot wire for an antenna. They'll probably want to bond the grounds together so that they'll have the other half of the antenna. Otherwise, the receiver will sound deaf. But then those folks will have issues with common mode that, they'll have to have just because they've just got such a small antenna.
Which means they likely won't have much trouble with common mode with that short of an antenna.
What if they bond the ground, it'll make the antenna appear to be more sensitive, and then they may pick up some common mode. So the receiver front end tries to be architected so that it will cover the maximum number of use cases, isolated ground, bonded ground, or one where you externally have a special bias T to isolate both legs. And so I'm trying to make the receiver front end work in all three cases.
That's very great. Okay.
Okay, very good. Well, it sounds like we got that under control. I'll try to get my comments over to you tomorrow morning, Tom, Just have a couple things that look like they might be interesting. Like, I think we need to have two different kinds of 100 nanofarad capacitors because we have some 10 volt caps on the 12 volt line, which probably is not a reliability thing.
Okay, I missed that. I will certainly, that's a good comment.
And you know, from a cost point of view, I would suggest maybe just change all the caps to 25 volt. And that way we don't have to have two different 0.1s on there. But it depends on the cost difference between the caps because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, on the 100 nanofarads, I was trying to stick in with the 04, 02 capacitor size. And I don't remember. I thought the higher voltage ones were bigger.
I think you can get them now with an 04, 02, but they cost a lot more when you want the higher voltage. So we can make that choice. It's, two parts is not a hard deal. And there's only a few places where you need the higher voltage ones.
Yeah, but thanks for the comment. I found 2, 3, 4. Okay, I found 4 places. I'll get those fixed.
And did you, you said you managed to get the connector fixed, right? Do we still have issues with the pinout or not?
No, I got the connector fixed. Thank you for telling me about the magic keystrokes. I've been, you know, waiting for months trying to get that information so I could go edit it. I think I've got it all fixed now.
Yeah, the control B and the control N are actually available on the menu on the top, but I've learned to use the shortcuts. It's so much easier.
Okay, well, in hours and hours and hours of looking, I never did find it.
Yeah, okay. Ken tends to bury stuff like that.
Yeah, the second thing is I would discourage going to 2 millimeter headers, and the reason is some of the connectors also serve as jumpers in the front end, so they're simultaneously a connector or a jumper, depending on how you use it. And folks are going to try to put a 0.1 jumper between the two pins to jump them, and if they do it on a 2 millimeter connector, it's not going to be pretty.
Okay, I was just thinking that probably in that case, we ought to either use all 2 millimeter connectors and jumpers or all 0.1 connectors and jumpers. And while I do like the size advantage of the smaller ones, at least here anyway, 0.1s are more common.
Yeah, and I'm sure that folks have 0.1 jumpers in their junk box, and I'm sure that when they bond when they apply the jumpers, you can predict the number of folks who are going to put an English unit jumper on a metric header.
Yeah, with the attendant not good results. I think I did notice too, one of the jumpers you had was a ramp connector, and I think that's probably incorrect because the ramp connectors are good for plugs on them, but they're not good for jumpers, even though they're 10th inch. A jumper will fit on there, but the ramp's really not necessary.
Okay, I was looking and could not find any connector different than a ramp, so I need help there.
Okay, yeah, and I can do that because I got some parts lists that are huge, big ones that we've used over the years and contain common parts like that, and I didn't give you those, so my fault.
No problem. I'll look through the list and just identify them and give me an alternate, and I'll go fix it. I took what was available and figured we'd sort it out later.
Yeah, and one of the other things I did is if you notice on the part types, the names, they're called CONN for connector and HDR for header, and I think I even have some called JMP for jumper. So you could take the same connector, and it could be, if it's a two-pin one, it could be called a jumper or a header or a connector, depending on what the use is for it. So like the connector, I would make a ramp, and the jumper, I would make just two pins unshrouded.
Okay, we're probably going to have to talk a little bit. The layout won't care. You know, we can install whatever part into the same 0.1 pin spacing hole set. But you and I are, and maybe the layout guy are going to need to talk about exactly what we want to do, and we may have to mark up the bill of materials.
Yeah, the decals are the same. So you're right. They can, a ramp or a header or a connector. In fact, the connector and the header are exactly the same part number. The only difference is one of them might be a JP reference designator and the other one's a J.
Yeah, I am reluctant to go change J's to JP's because that requires editing a field I cannot edit. And I never have figured out how to edit that, and it's cost me days and days of work. So the second is that several of them are jumpers in one mode of operation, but they're connectors, headers in a different mode of operation. And so I have, you know, which one do you assign to those?
Right, right. So if it's part of the 4-pin connector, then obviously it's a J or a P. I try to make it also the P's are the male pins and the J's are receptacles, and just fine nuanced things like that. And as far as changing the reference designator and the part decal, it's on the same page, but it's so if you're editing a part and you double click anywhere outside of the part body, you get the properties page, which lets you change everything except those three things, the title and the reference designator and the PC board decal. You have to go up and say, when you got the component open, you got to go up to the properties menu and open that, and you can change them there.
Okay, where is this properties menu?
Hold on a second. Let me open OrCAD, and I'll because I don't remember. I know how to do it, so by muscle memory.
Yeah, because, you know, I've got over 100 hours messing with that.
Just give me a second here. Okay, if you open the part and you go into the options menu at the top, then there's the bottom entry is called package properties. And that lets you set the name, the part reference, and the PCB footprint. Cleverly hidden from all the other properties that you change, which are exactly the same, only different.
Yeah. This thing has a lot of magic keystrokes required. Documentation certainly would be wonderful.
And I suspect that maybe the reason they do that is because I don't think you can edit a part that you can get that field on a part that's on a schematic sheet. So, for instance, if you got a sheet open and you got a part on there and you say, oh, geez, it's U3, it's supposed to be U5, you can double click on the part and you can change that property that. Reference designator property on the schematic, and that's perfectly legitimate. Now, technically, you can double click on the part and open it and change the part name or the resistor value, which is doable, but you never want to do it that way because then that part is not a library part anymore. It's in your cache, but it's different from the part in your library, and now you have a discrepancy, so when you place the next one, it's not going to be right.
Yeah, I fixed that. I had before I learned the Control B, Control N thing today. I had no choice. I couldn't get to the parts of the connector I needed to modify, so I had to edit the one in the schematic. There was no other way to do it.
Yeah, and that's pretty much suicidal doing that. You get away with it, resistors and caps, but get into a big part like that, pretty soon your library gets so fouled up that you can't really figure out how to get out of it.
Yeah, so I went and undid all I did once I learned the magic keystrokes and fixed it in the library and then repopulated the part.
Yeah, and you'll find out that there's one thing that you can't do. If you have a part that is a single part, like, say, a connector, and a part like our 140-pin connector that's four pieces, you cannot go between a multiple part package and a single part package. You have to start over. It will not let you switch that once you've defined the part.
I've started over so many times, no problem.
Yeah, really. So you become an expert, not by design, but by de facto.
Anyway, okay. Thank you for that. I will write up that. I just did it, and I got it to work just like you said. So I've got that. I'll go check the caps. And we're going to need to do a cleanup on jumpers and headers and look over the schematics and tell me how you'd like that. When I printed out the PDFs, all my dotted lines turned into solid lines. Maybe that's a scale factor problem on the PDF.
Yeah, it is. And what are you using for a PDF writer? What program?
Microsoft Print to PDF.
Yeah, so I'm not. I found that the dotted lines don't like certain PDF writers. So I don't know if I use Cute PDF or I use Microsoft, or I actually have a real Adobe printer installed that does it. And this was before Microsoft decided to include this in Windows. So all the dotted lines around your areas for the ground planes, they come out solid?
They do on the A-size PDF printout. When I look at them on screen, they show dotted. What I did, I was trying to help the layout person there by showing them which pins of the headers lay over which ground planes.
Yeah, I saw that. That's good. But the thing you might try is when you PDF print it, go into the PDF writer and change the print size to B or C, and then let your screen shrink it down. That might make it work.
Okay, that or I'll go in and I'll change the lines so they don't lay on top of the wires. The schematic is good because wires are red and lines are black, but when you've got a black line directly on top of a red line, it's totally confusing for the reader. I'll figure something out that makes it look better.
Okay. Yeah, and I think I've discovered that no matter what, if you double click on the line or the box, you can pick different kinds of dashes, like, you know, dash dash space, dash dash space, or dash 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 space, different formats. And I think that PDF Writer doesn't understand any of that, so you get solid lines no matter what you pick.
Okay. Well, I'll come up with something that's a little better than what's on there. A lot of the schematic is an attempt to help the layout guy figure out what I'm asking him to do.
Yeah, I know. Me and my CAD guy go back and forth in arguing about this, because I noticed that on the DAC, or on the ADC, you put the caps next to the pins you want them to be, more or less. But on the connectors and some of the other, like the caps on 3.3 and 1.8, you just put them all on the fourth page, and then you have notes telling them where to place them, which both are viable options. But I find it humorous that I tend to put the caps, I used to put them next to the pins, and then I decided that putting them all on one page with notes was better. And then the CAD guy decided he didn't like that, so he wants me to put them next to the pins. So every design, we seem to be out of phase, and we argue about it.
Well, I've got most of them on the last page with notes, and we'll figure it out.
Yeah, that works. I mean, he's knows how to do it either way. One thing I would ask is that for the revision, you put XA1 in there, because I'll explain how we work the revisions where I work is. We put an X in front of something before it's built. So we go X and then the rev that it will become, which is A, first revision, and then we use a number. So we got XA1, XA2, XA3, XA4, all the way up to however many we need, XA100 if we need. And the idea is that when you transfer the schematic to me, it becomes mine and I bump the letter, the number rather. So you drew XA1, you send it over to me, and then I'm going to make some changes. I'll make it XA2. And then when I send it back to you, you'll make it XA3. And when we send it over to the CAD guy, he's allowed to make changes. So when we give it to him, the baton is passed, so to speak. We're not allowed to make any changes to it. He's got the master. If he makes changes, then it becomes XA4. And we keep bumping it up until at some point we're done and we go build a board, then it becomes A. And then from then on, any changes to that become XB1, and that's the next spin. And then we go XC and XD, et cetera.
Okay, very good. I've just marked them all NC for, no change, meaning it's the original.
And the other thing I do too is I put a cover sheet on the front with a change block and a name. So if I make a change, then I put what I did. If you make a change, you'd put what you did. And then in this case, it's not hardly necessary, but there's usually a table of contents block that says sheet one is this, sheet two is this, sheet three is this. But in the four-page schematic, it's maybe unnecessary, although I do kind of like the change block.
Yeah, this style of change ID is called picture coding, where each letter has a particular functionality in it. And that would generally have been a fireable offense where I worked.
What, you mean XA1, XA2, XA3 like that?
No, X meaning not built, A meaning the board version, number meaning the version within the board. That would be a totally unallowed, never, never, ever allowed style of revision coding.
Really? That's interesting, because the first place I ever worked out of school is where I learned how to do this. And they had it so that they actually had X, Y, and A. And so if it was X, it was very experimental beginning, first draft. And then after they built one and made some changes, then it became a Y. And then when it became a production board and they built lots of them, then it became an A. And then they had 1, 2, 3, 4 as different revisions within that. Like when they put ECOs on, they bumped the number, even though the base board was the same.
Yeah, so anyway, there's lots of different theories as to how to do that, and just as many strongly held opinions.
Yeah, I believe that. I've probably seen half of them, or most of them, and argued for and against, and sometimes argue for one time and against another time.
Yeah, so at any rate, we can set that up however you want, and when... I'll put a cover page on. Do you need miscellaneous notes and build instructions and layout instructions? What do you need on the cover page?
Let me just send you a sample one, and you can go from there and modify it however you think. It's not critical that it be the same. It's just good to have the information there.
That's fine. Just send it to me as a PDF.
Okay. And I can send it to you as a test.sch, and you could just cut the page out, paste it right in, and then edit it.
I have no idea what an SCH is.
Sorry, a DSN. I'll send it to you as a schematic, and then you can cut the page out and paste it in. And it's all just text and lines, so there's no parts or anything on it.
Okay, very good. I'll wait for that. Any other? Get me any other comments, and I'll roll another rev by next week.
Okay, sounds good. And by the way, whenever I distribute a drawing to anyone outside the plant, it gets a new XA number, so XA2, XA3, XA4, but we don't have to get too picky about that.